This episode and all of our South by Southwest coverage is brought to you by Black Magic Design. Hey everybody, this is John Fusco and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. If there's one universal truth about filmmaking, it's that it's hard as hell to get your picture made. So if you're going to go through all the trouble of making a movie, you better damn well make sure you're not scared to tell the story that you want to tell. Luckily, there's no better time to do this than at the very beginning. Rick Alverson is one of the most daring filmmakers on the planet. His latest film, The Mountain, is a surreal odyssey concerning the very heart of creativity itself, the mind. Or rather, the antiquated science behind destroying it. In the film, Ty Sheridan plays a young man who, after losing his mother, goes to work with a doctor, portrayed by the unhumanly charismatic Jeff Goldblum, who specializes in lobotomies. The timing of this film's release is no coincidence. While we may not be walking around the streets with a literal blade being held to our skull, every day we are subject to creative suppression from an overabundance of media, screens, and pop culture. And while mainline cinema may do its best to further this narrative, Alverson argues that it's our duty as independent filmmakers to buck the trend and create art that leads to critical thinking. It's a truth that he learned sometime along the middle of his career, that filmmaking should be about having a conversation with a medium and not a promotional exercise. Filmmakers should meditate on how they can contribute to the art form itself and not look for personal advancement. There's no better time to start this practice than at the very beginning. I sat down with Alverson and Sheridan to discuss how filmmakers can look to achieve this very notion at South by Southwest. Enjoy. Hey everybody, this is John, and I'm here with Rick Alverson and Ty Sheridan. Even though I just introduced you guys, I'm going to let you introduce yourselves just so the audience knows who's speaking when they speak. So,
starting okay, I'm Ty Sheridan.
And I'm Rick Alverson, the filmmaker. Kidding.
Perfectly.
I'm Ty Sheridan.
And I'm Rick Alverson.
And Rick is the director of The Mountain. And Ty, what's the name of the character that you play in The Mountain?
Andy. Andy's the character I play.
And I saw the film. It's right up my alley. It's just like a surreal, dark, unique story about a traveling lobotomist and something which I've never really seen the likes of before. I was wondering if we could actually first focus in that sense on the visual decisions you made in terms of the look of the film, because it's really a beautiful film to look at. There's so much going on in every frame. Can you talk a little bit about what the discussions you had with your cinematographer beforehand to make it feel so rich and dynamic?
I think? Yeah, my DP, he shot Entertainment that Ty was in also in my last film, and his name's Lorenzo Hagerman. And I mean, the film really strives to question the ubiquitous value of narrative, and so it's sort of I like to think of it as like an obstruction film, a beige obstruction. I mean, it's very much about the form and everything about it. I mean, even the stilted sort of like blocking and the tableau like shots and everything. It's almost like a museum quality artificiality at times. And, mm-hmm. While that might seem beautiful, at the same time, it's not really that romantic tonally, you know.
No, it's disquieting, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to, we were like struggled and were interested in removing some of the typical romance of the period, you know, of the 50s, and that cinematically, even in the dark narratives about the mid-century, there's inevitably a kind of intoxicating beauty about it this sort of, you know, we tried to neuter a little bit. So
can you also talk a little bit about is it a 1-to-1 ratio that you guys shot in? What was that?
No, that would be the Mommy Xavier Dolan ratio, which is very nice.
Yeah.
Did you see that, Mommy?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did the Instagram 1-to-1.
Yeah.
It's 4-3.
It's 4-3.
Yeah.
Straight up.
What
was the decision making behind that?
A pedestrian viewpoint, I love the idea that, like, we in widescreen that with the, inevitably we're watching these things on our on our televisions or our computers. Let's be honest about it. And but with the widescreen and CinemaScope and that sort of thing, things that we feel are really cinematic by their nature. You know, we have we lose screen on the top and bottom, mm-hmm. And you know, in 4:3 you lose it on the sides. But for some reason, it feels like an obstruction on the sides. It's almost annoying to the viewer to have black bars on the right and left, while on the top and bottom we welcome it with open arms, which is really interesting to me. You know, and I love this idea that you sort of like, it feels like an obstruction that you would want to get around, or you're like, you know, what's on the other side when somebody passes, you know, out of the frame, which they don't typically do.
You think that's because we're accustomed to seeing the format that way?
I think it has to just do with the romance of CinemaScope, and that when we move from generations, when we move from 4:3 televisions to 16:9 monitors, we want to see the whole thing. You know, it's like, but people don't think about frames. You know, it's like suddenly we have total access if it goes to the edge of the frame. Well, what's to the left of your television?
Well, that was another thing that, I mean, I remember on set, it was a very conscious effort of yours to always keep the subject in the frame. I don't think there's one shot where someone walks in and out of the...
There is at the very end, when Andy leaves the car.
Oh,
I let him
yeah.
go out of the frame right. because he opened the car door. So
right.
I'll let people leave the frame if they go through doors or if they go into a hallway and they, you know, but they can't leave. I hate them leaving the frame.
I tried to leave the frame
of their own
so
volition.
Many times, and you
yeah.
said,
because I it's sort of it feels it's too easy on the audience to, it's almost like the it would seem like it would emphasize the frame, but I think it does the exact opposite. It allows you to believe that you're looking through sort of a peephole, and you know, I think we like people to leave the frames. And of course, you know, I don't want to make people happy. because it liberates us. We feel like, oh, it's okay.
No liberty in this film.
It does feel very confining, I think, with that
yeah,
in regard.
Right.
But also yeah. something, another side effect of that is kind of it makes you acutely aware that you're watching a film. You know what I mean? It's not like...
Good. I think that that's a, can be a very healthy thing.
Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's the whole formal emphasis of, like, we're a content-driven society, you know, and we don't so much so that we don't know the least thing about, like, a chair that we would buy, or be able to look at a table and realize it's only going to last us 5 years, you know. And there's all of the problems with social media and all of the problems in the election were because of an absence of formal intelligence. I mean, children have critical formal intelligence that most adults in the United States don't have any longer, because it's winnowed away from them. I mean, they're essentially taught to be ignorant of what they're looking at and just to pay attention to the story.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if a child were to be held by Donald Trump, it would be horrified by
the orange
monster. You know, a population looks at him and says, you know, oh, well, here's a self-made man. That's a narrative. Mm-hmm. They're not actually like saying, wow, this guy is a con man, you know?
You have so many, you know, speaking about frames, there's so many times in the movie where actually there's like frames within frames, and, you know, people in doorways, people in windows, a lot of squares, I find. Is that something that you, a decision that you make in pre-production? Do you know that you'll be like shooting in places that are architecturally designed like that? Or is that something you specifically look for on the scout and then that informs your decision?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, it's me and Lorenzo have a similar aesthetic kind of proclivities, but, you know, you look for, yeah, you, I mean, yeah, you're looking for those sort of architectural corners and opportunities.
Where did you shoot the film? Because it really feels like, you know, a place that's stuck in time, and the fact that these places still even exist anymore is like unbelievable to me.
We shot in New York State between Bronx and Finger Lakes.
Really?
Seneca, and we shot a lot in Willard, which is now the Willard Asylum. The Willard Drug Treatment Facility that used to be the Willard Asylum for the Chronic Insane. Hmm. That was our primary hospital. But most of them have been torn down. All of the Kirkbride hospitals.
And around Syracuse as well.
Yeah, we're around Syracuse, Utica, Ithaca, Albany.
Albany was
Kingston.
The hydroelectric plant that we went to in Albany was
We shot at the what was that place? The Edison Hudson.
The Edison Power Ford.
It's not in the film.
Okay.
And then we shot in the Pacific Northwest in the Olympic Rainforest in Mount Baker.
Okay. You touched on it when we were talking about society's inability to sort of see past a certain narrative. And your movie deals with lobotomy in a pretty heavy sense. Why now? Why tell this story about lobotomy now?
Well, I think I'm interested in discomfort in cinema because I'm interested in active audiences that are accessing their innate critical intelligence, that they're sort of asking questions and they're struggling and they're activated, and then they leave the theater and the hope is that they're changed some way, or that they perceive the world differently, which is to me the value of art. Because cinema is such a commodity, I mean, so often it just anesthetizes us and it pacifies us and it validates us, and it can be a relief, and there's a place for comfort cinema, but it occupies the majority of the market for a number of reasons. I think one of them being that passive audiences are great consumers. They eat a lot of junk food, and they don't go to the voting booths. So perfect populace.
Yeah. Ty, can you talk a little bit about playing the character and your development of the character with Rick, in the sense of, I got a sense throughout the film that, you were lobotomized yourself, throughout the entire thing. Was that a choice that you two had made together, or?
I think the most interesting thing about the character, especially the most challenging, is that he's an inaccessible protagonist. And I think that, just to piggyback on what Rick was just saying about, having an active audience and an audience that's the movie's forcing them to think critically about the content they're watching. I think that he, as you say, not only serves as a surrogate, but I think he also provokes that. And I think that it was just going against the grain, and that effort was, pretty interesting. For me, he's like taking in the movie and, all of its context in parallel to the audience a little bit. So it's almost as he serves as the lens that we're seeing the world through in I guess kind of an objective light.
Yeah, when you're not watching from the audience standpoint, being aware that you are watching the cinema or the movie, you're watching through your point of view, which is an equally discomforting sort of point of view. You mentioned inaccessibility, and I think that inaccessibility, my own personal tastes, I'm drawn towards these inaccessible films for the same reasons that you just described. But I find that filmmakers are discouraged, especially emerging filmmakers, people who are making their first shorts or first features, are discouraged from taking that risk and making inaccessible films. Do you have any words of advice to filmmakers who are dealing with sort of their own sort of inhibitions about taking that risk?
Well, I mean, at that point in your career, or lack thereof, I mean, that's the time to experiment and try to develop, and there shouldn't be those sort of rules, I mean, it is about you don't have the concerns that a professional, or a person who has a career in filmmaking has. They're essentially being jostled between the demands of the marketplace and their own livelihood, and their, you know, it's a constant, wrestling with different compromises. So, I mean, I think they should, the young people should be, or when I made my first film at 38 years of age. So, anybody who's starting out should feel liberated to try to develop a voice and not worry about the compromise of accessibility, certainly.
Throughout your career, I mean, you've been making these sort of dark, surreal films. How have you grown more comfortable or more confident in that voice?
I think it's that you want to have a conversation with the medium, and I think I realized that in my third film, The Comedy, because the aesthetic is not one that I really care for, but fit the material. And the subject matter I find reprehensible, but suddenly it wasn't a promotional exercise, which my first two films to some degree, why I value them, they felt promotional. My aesthetic, the tonalities that I'm interested in, subject matter that I sort of was curious about. I mean, they aren't entirely that. I mean, the comedy felt like, wow, I'm having a conversation with a medium, and I'm having a conversation with the world through the medium in a way that, like, it felt valuable, utilitarian. And so I think that I've kind of moved off of that and sort of been inspired by that since then.
In the term promotional, do you mean sort of promoting certain parts about your own abilities to make film, or
promoting your interests, your aesthetic, your sort of it's an exaggerated, like, using cinema as a megaphone as opposed to as a medium for interaction with the world. Are you curious about the world? Do you want to listen to the world? Do you just want to listen to your own voice,
As you've become more confident in yourself as a filmmaker without having to necessarily promote those or exaggerate those tendencies, your filmmaking tendencies, how does that free you up? What other tendencies begin to emerge?
I don't think it frees you up. It makes things more complicated.
Okay.
But it makes the medium valuable. Hmm. I mean, for yourself, because you'll learn about the world, you learn about the medium. It increases the dimensions of the thing,
And when you create a period piece like this, what are the hallmarks that you use to build the period or the vibe, like the production design, the art design?
Yeah, there's just a ton of hard work from a lot of people. And Jacqueline Abrahams, who she did The Lobster previous to this.
Oh, wow.
She did the production design, and Elizabeth Warren, we worked with on Entertainment, did the costume. And these, like, are the amount of, like, sweat equity that's in that film from those women is tremendous, So, it's a ton of headaches.
Are there any things in particular that filmmakers looking to create a period piece should place a lot of attention on as they are in pre-production or as they're writing the script, sort of things where detail is very important?
Well, I mean, would you say that you avoided the romanticism of the era? Because that's what you're most interested in.
I'm not so interested in celebrating cinema. There's enough celebration out there, So I think that any young filmmaker should look at the pool and say, what can I contribute? Where is there space for contribution? And if the pool's full, then I think that we should all really question about the necessity of us doing something, because there's a lot of resources that go into this business, And those resources come from somewhere. They come on the backs of finite places. And I don't know. I think filmmaking should be taken seriously as a privileged exercise, and looking at the world. Mm.
And Ty, for you, I mean, you're someone who's acted in both major blockbusters and smaller indie films. What can you say, based on your own experience, is the difference between the two, and which do you prefer? I mean, I think I know the answer to the question, but
I don't think there's any real preference. I think that anything that is I think for the most part, like, the rules are, is the movie going to be a challenge to me? And is it going to challenge someone else? And I think when the answer is yes to both of those questions, and I think then it becomes of interest. And I don't really, you know, put major focus on, you know, whether it's a $200 million movie or a $200,000 movie. And I guess, you know, in this sense, with this film, you know, I think it was more interesting to explore something that that goes against, you know, the standards of cinema, of contemporary cinema, and easy content, you know, satisfaction, and something that is, you know, a narrative that is kind of spoon-fed to you. You know, I think that there's no other filmmaker out there that is probably focused on that as much as you are in a specific sense.
It's because it's a bad idea.
But it's interesting, you know, and it's like, I do think that we should be conscious of the content that we're pouring into the ecosystem and what it means and how it's pacifying us. So, you know, to go back to your question about, you know, big studio movies and the difference between those and doing indie films. I mean, I like to have balance, and I think at times, you know, like there are times when I want to go and I want to be entertained, and there are times when I want to be challenged as an audience member. So are there times where I want to see something really beautiful and something, you know, conscious of its form? And then there are times where, you know, I just maybe want to be excited. And so I think, you know, there's a difference between those types of films and those different categories of in cinema.
I like asking actors who join us on the podcast what it is about working on this film with this director, strategies that this director used that you like, that you'd wish you'd see other directors use more often.
I think it's, you know, from Rick, I think it's the bravery, the amount of the curiosity as well. I think he's really conscious about his films, and in a way that I think a lot of people are not. And I think consciousness about content, and when you're conscious about your work you're putting out as an artist, I think that's kind of in sync with responsibility, and it kind of runs parallel. And I think that he understands that, and I always respected that, and that's one reason that I love working with him. You know, we've done two movies together now, and also just the collaboration. Rick's an easy guy to collaborate with. He doesn't really, he's pretty egoless for the most part. And I think that's really refreshing.
We have a lot of fun too when we're doing this.
Yeah, no, it's not always so like
can be a
dull
bummer, like me and Todd like have a laugh. I mean, it's sometimes making the most sort of debilitating, you know, content can be a really giddy, liberating experience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's strange. And sometimes it confuses people on set. I mean, there were some crew that were sort of, we had been up for days and days and days, and there was
completely delirious.
Yeah. There was this scene where a lobotomy was taking place, and it was so gnarly that it hyperbolically stepped over a line into the absurd, and it was like a total crying laughter fit of catharsis that spread throughout, you know, the more irreverent of on the crew, and it was
I wanted to also touch on there is a point in your film where the tone seems to shift drastically, and it's with, I think his name is Levon? Denis Levon, where he starts talking about sort of the nature of art. and then it delves into the philosophical. And I was wondering if those were your words or if those were words that had been adapted and sort of what it means to you.
Me and Colm O'Leary, my co-writer, came up with the monologues for Denny.
What was that writing process like? It's just, it was
fascinating. I mean, it was informed by a lot of, early surrealist sort of theatrical work like La Tremont and Antonin Artaud and a certain kind of, combustible ego. But we also wanted it to be circuitous and like a labyrinth and difficult to follow. But there's narrative, stitched narrative content and everything that's said. It isn't, some people would say, oh, it was gibberish, but it's not. And I think that was important for the character because he's desperate to exhaust himself, and he has a form of exhaustion, mm-hmm. a particular form of male exhaustion that I think reaches a tipping point into the capacity for emotion, so. He's also, we need to remember, Andy's, Ty's character, Andy, is a surrogate for the audience, as protagonists are, at this point has been irrevocably changed. We don't understand how, mm-hmm. But we're feeling it. Mm-hmm. He's subject to this mania,
right.
And so are we, and we're as helpless as he is, and that sort of tickles me a bit.
Yeah, in the moment, like I said, the whole movie seems to change after our surrogate also.
Yeah, some people changes. That drives crazy. Oh, I mean, I've heard it from a few people. They're sort of like, it goes off the rails is what's said. But I mean, it does. I mean, it should.
I agree. Great, guys. Well, I'm just going to wrap up here by asking you a question I like to finish off these interviews with. And that is, if you had one golden piece of advice for emerging filmmakers, emerging, and for you too, I guess along the lines of what you've said you appreciated about Rick's work, what advice would you give to emerging filmmakers, directors?
I think more now than ever, because, of the type of movies that consume theaters, it can be hard to get your voice heard, and if it's unique, I think not always, people may not always get it, but that doesn't mean that it's not good. It just, I think like Rick said, you asked about risk earlier, and like how young filmmakers are afraid to explore a narrative that might be quite inaccessible. But, I think that art is constantly, the boundaries needs to be pushed always. And I think you need to, challenge yourself, challenge the work, challenge the content that's existing. And I think, it's not easy to become a filmmaker or an actor or any artist and do it overnight or just be good at it overnight. So, I think hard work and dedication and curiosity more than anything, asking questions and learning when you can and paying attention and trying to understand intention beneath the story and the and films is really important. So I think if you have something you feel strongly about doing and it's the only thing you can think about, then do it, because I don't think you'll ever be satisfied until you've fed that craving.
Yeah, you've at least tried.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Rick, how about you?
We're a very privileged society, and maybe the most privileged on the face of the earth, and we can do anything we want. But I think it's increasingly important for us to ask: should we? Why should we? What is necessary? What is our value? And therefore, I think that's a road to finding out what your contribution can be, and also a way to sculpt, your what you have to offer and your uniqueness, So.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Enjoy
thanks.
The rest
Thank
of
you.
Bye.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the No Film School podcast on whatever podcast platform you so choose to use. You can listen to interviews just like this every Monday. And of course, check out the site for up-to-the-minute news on everything about independent filmmaking. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me on Twitter at @Jim_John_Jim. You can follow No Film School at No Film School. Until next week, take it easy.